This podcast is brought to you by Money Control.
Hello and welcome to Season 5 of Simply Safe Podcast at Money Control. I'm Kaizad Adajania. In this season, we've been speaking to some of India's top mutual fund managers and asking them how to pick stocks and sectors beyond the numbers. What do they see in companies that you and I do not see? Meeting company managements, visiting factories, studying their practices, corporate governance, how do all this influence a fund manager's decision? For today's episode, I caught up with Manish Gunwani. He is the CIO, Equity Investments at Nippon India Mutual Fund. This was earlier Reliance Nippon India Mutual Fund. Manish told me that for the top 200 odd companies, company visits aren't actually necessary. In fact, technology and transparency, he added, has evolved so much, he told me, that a company's moves and decisions are now well broadcasted. And then there is also a lot of sell-side research available today. But yes, for mid-cap and small-cap companies, visiting companies, their plans can give a fund manager precious insights. Let's listen to what Manish has to say.
Yeah, Manish, hi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
First question, let's begin by asking you, how much has, you know, investing changed in the past so many years? Because you've been in the business for so long. How has it changed for you as a fund manager?
So if I go back, let's say about 20 years, maybe, there is a lot of difference in the sense that I think the most stark thing I can see is that the role of macro and global markets, that has gone up quite a lot. So let's say 15, 20 years back, I remember that as stock pickers, we would probably read inflation data in the next day's newspaper. So even if it came out at 11 in the morning, we wouldn't even pay any attention to it. And just in the next day's newspaper, we would just see, oh, inflation was this much.
Okay.
But today, I think globally, markets are so macro-driven that things like macroeconomic indicators of the market you are operating in, let's say India, and also the indicators of other countries like US, Europe, Japan, China, they have started mattering more and more. I guess it's partially got to do with the fact that central banks themselves have become so active globally. And there is a sense that a lot of market movement is driven by central bank actions. But whatever be the case, I think one is that these macro things have started mattering more. The other thing I see is that the integration, or rather the learnings from other asset classes, like bonds, currencies, fixed income, that is getting more and more tight, in the sense that, let's say, if you go back to a year like 2013, I think it was the kind of year where currency took center stage, and it was like the equity markets followed the currency market. And I think what that has changed is that today, as a fund manager, you are much more following or keeping a watch on a lot of other asset classes as well. So you need to have a broad view on what is happening to, let's say, the US bond yields, the emerging market currency index, the commodity markets, because all this will influence foreign flows, which in turn will influence Indian markets. And also directly through business impact, right? That raw material prices or interest rates will get influenced by all this. So essentially, I think markets are moving more in tandem with both global equity markets and are getting more and more influenced by other global asset classes.
So there's an information overflow also.
I would probably say that markets are getting more efficient.
Okay.
So maybe 20 years back, we were too small also, maybe, you know, the size of our economy was so small that if there is an outflow from emerging markets, we could have survived because of our size. But today, if our economy is 2.5-3 trillion, if our stock market is 1.5-2 trillion market cap, let's say there is a global trend of outflows or inflows into emerging markets, we will get sucked into that trend irrespective of what happens on the domestic side. Mm. Also, I think the sense is that some of these other asset classes react faster than the equity markets.
Okay.
So, for example, if you look at the currency market, I think the global events first probably impact the currency rather than the equity market. A lot of times we've seen that. And you need to, I think, as a fund manager, be aware of broadly what is happening in all the four global markets, which is equities, bonds, currencies, and commodities. Because if there are some extreme movements that are happening in any of these markets, so there is a earnings impact and there's a capital flow, correct, which is a PE impact also in a sense. So these are very important things which over the last 20 years, I think people have become more aware. They're driving markets much more than we used to. Second is, I think overall, there is more and more transparency. So among, let's say, the top 200 or 300 companies by market cap, today the information asymmetry is gone. So earlier, let's say 20 years back, you could have had an edge by meeting the company regularly or getting their plans on CapEx and all that. Clearly, that is gone now because top 200, 300 companies, they do an earnings call. The sell side has very in-depth coverage on these companies. Information asymmetry, or the swiftness with which you get information, that used to be an edge 20 years back. Clearly, that edge has died down. Part of it is also regulatory, that obviously due to regulation, the companies' disclosures are very transparent and very uniform between institutional investors and minority investors. So a lot of companies have the con call transcripts on their website.
Okay.
They have webcast of their events and all that. So I think that's a very healthy sign to my mind that there is much more freer flow of information.
Okay. So you were saying that earlier you had an edge by visiting companies, by talking to them on a one-on-one basis. But today there is so much of research out there. Sales side research is also, so that the top 200 or so companies are covered by enough information that's out there.
Yeah.
But does it mean that fund managers don't need to meet companies, or do you still meet companies and do you still get to?
No, we do, but a lot of it is happening through technology, where, as I said, a lot of them do earnings call.
Okay.
So you get a fairly...
But that's limited only to the top 100, 200 companies, because you guys manage a lot of small caps, large caps
also. Even mid caps are doing a lot. Of course, the smaller the company, the less these kind of mechanisms are there in place. And in a way, you need to work harder to analyze a smaller company versus a larger company. Also, what tends to happen with larger companies, of course, the quality of sell side research is almost directly proportional to size of the company. So if it's a $20 billion market cap, you will obviously have very good sell side coverage. If it's a $200 million market cap, you will not have great sell side coverage usually. Most of our investments are in top 200, 300. To that extent, a lot of our investments are driven by trying to create a differentiated insight, which is not coming from just talking to the company more often or having access to management, which is better than anyone else, because all these things have got evened out.
Okay.
So it is more about having deeper research, studying global examples, doing a lot more channel checks rather than just interacting with the company.
But do you go and meet companies otherwise when you have to go beyond 250 stocks?
No, even across the large ones and small ones, we obviously do a lot of plant visits, we meet a lot of management, that we do. All I'm saying is that for the top 200 companies, let's say HNI and us, there is not very big difference in what resources each of us have. Because a lot of the information is given out through presentations or earning con calls, which are there on the website of the company. And as I said, I think that's a very healthy trend.
Okay.
Because the market information is now becoming very free.
And how much do you rely on your own research versus sell-side research? Do you interact a lot with the sell-side research?
So we obviously have a very high level of engagement with sell side, but we think that our research team is a big USP for us. We have one of the biggest coverage universes on the street.
As in terms of companies?
In terms of companies. So we cover more than 550 companies.
Okay. And between how many people research?
So we have 12 analysts across two teams. Okay. So we think that that is very important for a large asset manager to have a very high quality research team and a very wide coverage. Because obviously we feel that the Indian market will keep compounding.
Okay.
Lot of small companies will become big companies. So from that perspective, obviously we feel research is a very big focus area for us. It's a very big competitive advantage for us.
But the resources that you feel, you're saying that by way of being such a large AMC as you already are, if you say that your resources available to you would be almost the same as what resources would be available elsewhere, even to an HNI investor, then how would you sort of retain your edge in terms of...
No, what I meant is what the company's communication is, that has become evened out between different kinds of investors.
So the same amount of information that's available to you...
20 years back, Tata Steel was holding an analyst meet. Now, obviously, limited amount of people can attend that analyst meet, which is in Bombay, one pocket of Bombay, right? But today, if Tata Steel wants to talk about its earning, it will release a presentation which is there on the website. It will host an earnings call which is open for broadly everyone. The information you get from a company has got evened out. But at the same time, research, to my mind, has become even more bigger competitive advantage because you have to get an insight which is not dependent on what the company is telling you. You need more experienced people who've seen cycles so that they can predict how the cycle is shaping up in a lot of these cyclical industries. You need to probably understand some foreign companies in the same sector because the operating metrics of a steel company in India will be correlated with what is happening to a Thyssen or a ArcelorMittal globally as well. So you need to be able to do all that to get a differentiated insight.
So when you do go and visit companies, what is it that you see beyond the ordinary?
It's about the DNA. Now, it could come about by seeing the quality of the neatness at the plant, the way things are working in an orderly manner. The second is when you meet management, one of the things I like to see is very decentralized decision making. Because see, a lot of times when you buy stocks in India, since India itself is one of the highest nominal growth countries in general, you want stocks which can grow 5-10 years and become very big. And for that to happen, you would want to see a company which is not just dependent on the promoter making all the decisions. So what you like to see is a company which has a very empowered second and third line of management. And you try and get a sense that even if the promoter were to, let's say, take leave for 3 months, whether this company will do well. Because it should not be that everyone's pushing all the decision making to the top. So there are various ways to figure this out. You look at compensation levels of the second or third rung of people. You look at the track record of the company, how it has grown. You try to figure out how much is the promoter involved in the business. Is he spending 18 hours? Is he spending 5 hours? All that will give you a clue whether the decision-making is decentralized. I think that's one important thing for me.
Who do you normally approach to? I mean, when you go for your company, when we engage with companies, I mean, is this only the senior most line? Do you go beyond the MD, CEO? Do you go down the chain?
It all depends. Some companies allow that access, some companies don't. Typically, what we've seen is most of the time during the year, there is a certain set of officers from the company which are meeting investors, whether the CEO, CFO, IR. And maybe once or twice in the year when they hold analyst meet, you get access to the operating heads. So that's one way I think a lot of large companies are operating at this point of time. I think the other thing which is also important is to figure out what financial metrics is the company paying focus on. So I think a lot of behavior of companies, and this is what we try to find out when we meet them, is about how are they thinking, whether market share is more important or absolute growth is more important, whether profitability is more important or growth is more important. I think every company has a DNA to focus on. See, you can't be good in everything, right? And you can't, in a lot of industries, you can't say that I will shoot for market share and profitability and growth at the same time. I think one of the things we try to get from companies is the DNA about growing at all cost. And in some cases, that's a good objective, especially when you're very small. But at the same time, if you're sacrificing profitability or if you're sacrificing return on equity, that becomes a red flag. So you try to find out when they're planning their targets, what are they... So that is...
Any examples that come to your mind when you would have, in your normal course, when you meet companies, like some companies which you may, on the outside, you may like, but you know, when you go and speak to them, these kind of finer points come out and may have dissuaded you from...
It's not very recent, but if you go back about 10-15 years, and if you looked at the top two private sector banks in this country, and the way they behaved was very different, right? I mean, because one of them said that 25-30% growth is good enough for me, irrespective of what the market is doing, because that is the growth we can handle without losing focus on asset quality and other operating parameters. You had another bank which pressed the accelerator in a big way, and they were growing like 50-60% in retail, giving out loans and credit cards in a very, very aggressive manner. And clearly, it, I think, boiled down a lot about whether the top management was more focused on profitability or growth. Now, obviously, in the latter case, what tends to happen is if a macroeconomic downturn hits you, that can obviously spoil your balance sheet to a large extent. And that is what happened in 2008 when the downturn came. Reading into what managements are incentivized, what are they incentivizing the people below them, what are the boards asking from them. That's a very important way of trying to decipher how this management will behave.
When you go for plant visits, do you go out of your way to sort of talk to people who you wouldn't have ideally met or spoken to just get to know something more about the company that the next fund manager may not
know? I mean, you talk to people at the side for two or three things. One is to see how they've bought the vision of the top management. Because let's say the top management is saying that my minimum ROC is 25%. Over next 5 years, my margin will go here, etc., etc. So when you visit plants or facilities, to just check with people whether they are aware or, you know, how much have they bought into that vision of the top management.
For example, an auto company or something. That's very dependent on, you know, orders and demand. So you have a production line which is going on.
Correct.
But if nobody's buying in a downturn.
Yeah, then you see whether there's too much inventory at the plants, whether a lot of stock is lying around. But what I meant was, see, that is cyclical. But I think from a more structural sense, when you're trying to figure out the DNA of the company, it's also about how people have clarity about what the top management has told them and whether they've bought that objective. So whether people are very satisfied stating what the top management is telling people and whether how happy they are, how long have they been in the organization on average. So you talk to 5-10 people and figure out.
So it's not just about whether you are convinced of what the management is saying. You're trying to find out whether the employees are also convinced by the
company's vision. I think that is something which is very, very
important. Do you ever find a disconnect between the two?
We see varying levels of integration between what people at the lower level believe and what the organization is talking about as their objectives. It's not that the statements will be very different from, because all the top Yeah. Management make all these
visionary statements.
Apple pie and motherhood kind of statement.
Correct.
But I think, let's say an organization, or in general, it believes in return on capital as dharma. And at the lower level, if you don't find people aware of it, or people talking very casually about it, that's a red flag. Also, about quality, right? I mean, see, at the top level, everyone will talk about quality, right?
Correct.
No top manager will tell you that my quality is not great. But when you see the quality of the plant in an auto company in terms of how automated it is, whether robots are being used or there's a lot of manual effort, you get a sense about quality level of this plant versus some of its peers.
Any time you go back like 10, 20 years in your this thing, which you may have found something unexpected. But thanks to your probing.
So again, this is not very new, but obviously a lot of this stuff tends to happen in a bull market rather than a steady market we've seen over the last 5-7 years. But you go back to 2007, a lot of these small caps obviously were trading at expensive valuations. It was regarding a newspaper industry. Now, it was about that if you understood the economics of a newspaper in terms of what is the ad revenue you can get per column centimeter?
Say,
you know the broad readership of a newspaper.
Yeah.
So, if you could figure out that, let's say a Bombay leading newspaper is doing ad revenues of X, something in a Bangalore or Hyderabad can probably do X by 3 or X by 4. And if that company is reporting super normal profitability revenues, which are much more than that X by 3 or X by 4, you get a sense that this doesn't work, right? I mean, that is something which was very peculiar, I think. Again, for a pharma company, when we talk to some of the vendors who were supplying to that pharma company, and they give you, I mean, if you know some of these vendors well, they, for instance, one of the vendors said that the procurement DNA of the company is there's a lot of corruption and these guys waste a lot of money and all that. So, even though the stock on surface looks cheap all the time, and you always believe that with so much of unused capacity, so much of molecules filed in US, and this company one day will do well, but you always find that the operating margins keep on disappointing. Then sometimes, and I remember this back from 2007 again, that if you go to a plant and then figure out that with the kind of process that plant is having, the inventory levels as stated in the balance sheet, when you divide by the value addition value of the finished goods, it should be, let's say, X tons. But you figure out, even with a very cursory glance at the inventory that is lying at the plant, that it is X by 10. I mean, see, obviously, if it's X and if pointed X, you can't make out from the eye.
But if there is so much of
difference, but sometimes you find a lot of these, lot of these small caps, which are in a bull. It usually happens in a bull market, in a wild bull market,
because that's where claims really hit the roof, and the reality may be a little different.
Yeah, because see, promoters are incentivized only in a bull market, right? If you're reporting 1 rupee of EPS, you're getting 20 rupees of market cap. It is then when a lot of these things tend to come out.
Manish, you said a little while earlier, you know, when companies talk to you and they always talk well about their products, well about their DNA, well about their culture. If I may to extend the same parallel to fund managers, okay, and, you know, we have large funds, mid-size funds, small-size funds. Even when you speak to fund managers and when they tell you and ask them about how they do their research, what kind of companies they invest in, even they also say that we invest in well-managed companies, you know, we do this research, that research, etc. But we have seen many funds underperform in tricky markets. So is there a disconnect, or is that still part of the script?
I think it's a mix of different things. To a certain extent, what you're saying is true. If I look back about, let's say, on a 5-10 year basis, could we as an industry have avoided some of these disasters? Obviously, with better research, we should have. There is no denying that. If I look at what proportion of alpha the industry has lost because of fraudulent accounting or very bad corporate governance. It's material maybe, but it's not really the dominant factor. I think there are 2-3 thoughts here, right? One is that I think as an economy develops, alpha in general becomes more challenging. The reason for that is that typically as an economy develops, the IPR quotient of companies keeps going up. So what I mean to say is, if you were to look at India 20 years back, the topmost weights in the, let's say, BSE 100 or whatever would be steel, cement, very capital intensive, very simple industries. As the companies become more knowledge based, intangible, brand, distribution, technology, the complexity of information keeps going up. So that way, I feel that over time, to create alpha becomes more challenging for sure. So that is one part to it. Two is, we just like 95 to 2001, we saw a period where somehow nothing went right for the economy, both global and domestic. And year after year, something or other has caused the economy to stay below trend in a sense. And all the value guys have slowly kept migrating towards cyclicals. People who look at normalized price to earnings, price to book, low price to book, etc. They obviously are on the side of cyclical, and that's not played out. So, so the alpha which has been lost is also a lot about value investing not working. Value in the traditional sense of the word. The style of investing over last 10 years, which has worked, has remained the same. And since value and contra investors look at reversion to mean, frankly, that reversion to mean hasn't happened.
Okay. What about passive versus active? I mean, you have a fair share of passive. You acquired Benchmark Mutual Fund.
Yeah.
But you are a proponent yourself, are a proponent of active funds because you have been an active fund manager.
Yeah. So I think, see, what happens is there is always a cycle between mid-cap and large-caps. And when mid-caps do well, typically tends to create alpha. Right? So I think next 1 to 2 years, I think alpha will come back because cyclically we lost a lot of alpha 18 and 19, which can come back. Second is the underlying structural effect, which I was talking about economies becoming more complex, IPR centric. So midterm, I do see alpha as a challenge. But I also see very long term that alpha will come back because if you think about it, stock market is a momentum strategy, right? The better the company does, the more its weight in the index increases. A momentum strategy will always have its limits. And the more money that comes into passive, the more it will seed its own failure. Because obviously a momentum strategy, if you keep putting too much money into it, at some point it will blow up bubbles of extraordinary size, which will bust at some point. All stock market indices are momentum strategy is what makes me believe that at some point passive will also have its limit.
Manish, two last questions I wanted to ask you. One is that in the middle towards your responses, you said that investing has become a lot more complex now than what it was before. Now, you're one of the largest fund houses in India. You have your research team of about like what 10, 12 analysts, you said. That's on the larger side. If you compare yourself with other peers in the industry, a mid-sized fund house would have, let's say, 4 or 5. Okay. So yes, your research team is comparatively larger than the other fund houses. But given the complexities in the investment universe going up and up, do you think even 10, 11 research team is enough to decipher so many like 400, 500 stocks?
I think so. See, generally what we found is 30 to 40 stocks per analyst is a reasonable size because...
Okay, there are different industries also, no?
There are.
Of an expertise can you have like one?
Yeah, but you also have to remember that we get sell side support also in a lot of the stocks. So at this point, we feel it is good enough. But you're correct, maybe this answer will change 5 years down the line. So if in that 30, if I had Apple, Google, Facebook, Tesla, I would say 30 you can't do. You probably will do 10. But if I have cement companies, IT services companies, two-wheeler company, then I think 30-40 is okay.
Okay. Last question, Manish. You've spoken about quantitative research. You've spoken about qualitative research. Starting from the first question itself, there's so much of information overload today. Social media also plays a very, very large role. Okay. And we're living in very polarized times as far as opinions are concerned. People today express opinions not just about their own field, but, you know, we get sucked into a lot of a big picture opinion, a debate kind of a thing also. So I've seen many the companies from big corporations also voicing their opinions on what's going on in the political sphere within India, outside India. So you had somebody like Satya Nadella of Microsoft commenting on CAA and stuff like that, immigration and all that. Okay, I know Microsoft is not listed in India, but how do you, as a fund manager, interpret a company voicing its opinion in the political sphere, which may be against what you personally would believe? Would you still invest in that company?
I wouldn't go by what I personally believe or am against. I would generally be...
Would that make a difference to your...
I think companies should not make public statements on politics because, see, our stakeholders are very different. Right? I mean, as they say, the duty of a company or the dharma of a company is to cater to employees, customers and shareholders. I think it's not the business of a company to really comment on politics.
Okay. Thank you, Manish. Thank you so much.
That's all we have for you today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Over the next month and a half or so, we'll bring you many such conversations with some of our top fund managers around. If you have any feedback, anything to say or any queries that you want to write to us, our email ID is mcpodcast@mw18.com. I repeat, it's mcpodcast@mw18.com. For more news, views and updates, log on to moneycontrol.com.